Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden's State of the Union address last night was met with some outbursts from lawmakers in the crowd. A political rhetoric expert joins us for a look at the speech. First, the Bill of Rights is one of the cornerstones of American democracy. And in our political conversations these days, we talk a lot about protecting our individual rights and liberties. But our next guest is worried that we're forgetting another important part of American citizenship, responsibilities and obligations. In his new book, he argues that rights all by themselves are not what should define American citizenship, and that meeting our obligations as citizens is vital if our democracy, our political experiment in the U.S., is to continue and to inspire other countries around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be part of the job description of being an American citizen? Do you think people are well informed enough about politics, participate enough in daily and yearly politics? Do you want to see more civics education in schools? Just a few of the ideas our guest talks about in his book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Haass is president of the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations. He's served in the Pentagon, State Department, and White House under four presidents from different parties. He's written and edited a lot of books, including The World, A Brief Introduction, and Foreign Policy Begins at Home. His newest book is called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me.
You've had a career filled with looking at foreign relations and international threats to the United States. What turned you toward looking at the elements of citizenship?
Turned me to it initially is when people would invariably ask me what keeps me up at night. Instead of saying China or Russia or North Korea, I started saying us. And I started thinking about it, and it's essentially the threats to either the functioning of American democracy here at home, the gridlock that increasingly makes it difficult or impossible for us to pass policies that would allow us to deal successfully with our needs and challenges, or worse yet, the potential for order to break down. We had a glimpse of it on January 6th. I spent several years as the U.S. envoy to the Northern Ireland peace talks, and the idea that politically inspired violence, we saw it, the damage it did over there for over the course of three decades. And I've come away thinking that we shouldn't somehow assume or be sanguine that it couldn't happen, here. I take that possibility more seriously than I'm comfortable with.
And you write that countries around the world are watching the United States, in some cases looking for signs of chaos or dysfunction. And January 6th events were very popular on TV, for example, in China. You worry that if we're not getting things right here, it will encourage authoritarians around the world and discourage people who might embrace democracy otherwise.
Absolutely. The Chinese, the Russians, and others like nothing more than to see divisions here. On one hand, it justifies, at least in their lights, their own repression, their own lack of freedom, their own lack of respect for rights. They're also hoping that our internal divisions make it more difficult for us to come together to do things. I don't think it's a reach to think that Vladimir Putin, one of the reasons he thought he might have a relatively free hand in Ukraine, is he thought the United States might be too divided to mount any sort of a successful defense. And then if you look around the world, our friends and allies, by definition, they're people who have put their security or a lot of it in our hands. And if they see us divided, if they see us acting inconsistently without not being steady, then they will think twice or three times about that security decision. And either they will say, hey, we have to take matters in our own hands, which could be potentially dangerous, would certainly lead to a falling off of our influence. Or they may say we have to cozy up to a big neighbor, even if we don't like them, such as Russia or China. And again, that's not a world we want to see. So it turns out what happens here doesn't simply stay here.
You diagnose a fundamental problem with the United States as you see it, that may be behind all of this potential dysfunction, rights on the one hand, you're all for rights, you're not against those, but you worry that we've put too much of our focus, our political conversation, our political action, focusing on our individual rights and liberties at the expense of what obligations is there in your title?
Absolutely. As you suggest, I'm not against rights. To the contrary, I'm in favor of them. I think Abraham Lincoln had that profound line when he described our reality as our unfinished work. And even here, 2.5 centuries after the founding of this country, there's still a gap in times between our declared rights and the rights in reality. And it's incumbent upon us to narrow or eliminate those gaps wherever we find them. But even if we succeed at that, that's not in and of itself going to make American democracy work. How do you square the circle between, say, a woman's right to choose and the rights of the unborn, or an individual's rights to acquire and bear arms pursuant to the Second Amendment as they see it, and someone else's right to public safety, or one individual's right as they see it not to get vaccinated or be forced to wear a mask, and yet someone else's right to public health. How do we square these circles? And to me, a rights-based conversation in politics will either lead to deadlock, as we've often seen, to gridlock, or it could lead to violence. So again, my view is not that we shouldn't concern ourselves with rights, but a concern with rights alone is simply not an adequate basis for a democracy to make sure that it delivers to the people, and it does so in a nonviolent way. And that's what led me in the direction of obligations.
We're talking to Richard Haass. His newest book is The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the duties, the responsibilities, the obligations of citizenship in America? Is it voting? Is it participating in politics in more ways than voting? Are there ways you think we should do more to promote the common good, even if it doesn't directly benefit us as individuals? What do you want to see taught in schools when it comes to civics and how government works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Richard, you have 10 steps here, 10 ways you're hoping American citizens will meet these obligations. Let's start with number one in your book, simply being informed.
It was Ronald Reagan who said that he didn't just want patriotism, but he was very careful to say, I want an informed patriotism. And that means understanding something of our history, something of our political traditions, something about the value of democracy and what it takes to make it work. And then on a day-to-day basis, it means being up to speed on the policy choices that face us. How do you know who to vote for or what to support and what to oppose unless you're informed? And that also begs the question of what does it mean to be informed and how does one get informed? And I would simply say the reason I made it the first obligation, it's the basis for all else. Yes, I want to have people involved and participate to vote and get involved in politics another way. And I made that the second obligation, but it really needs to rest on a foundation of being informed. Recently, there was an encouraging development in New Jersey, where the governor signed into law a requirement that all students in New Jersey public schools take courses in information literacy. And the whole idea is to make them critical consumers of information. We're living in an age in which we're bombarded with information. The problem is we're also bombarded with misinformation. How does one tell the difference between the two? Where does one go for better information? So the idea that now in our schools, at least in one state, that's going to be taught, I see that as an encouraging development, and I would hope that other schools in other states would follow suit.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, you guys just talked on a topic that would interest me. At 30, 40, 50 years old, this is interesting, but I think it would be indispensable to make sure that kids at 16 and 17 got this. So I'm wondering what program is available to disseminate this to and through all high schools in the United States.
Steve, thanks for the call. And civic education, support the teaching of civics is one of your 10 duties of citizens, obligations of citizenship. Could you talk more about that, Richard?
Sure. Thank you, Steve, for raising it. I think it's critical. Just to be clear, civics are taught in quite a few of our high schools. In most of those where it is taught, it gets though only half a year of instruction. There's nothing common necessarily to what is taught in this school district as to another, even within states, much less from state to state. And then civics at the college level and university level, they're offered on virtually every campus, but they're required by almost none. Very few colleges actually require a grounding in civics as a condition for getting your diploma. I'd like to radically change that. I would like middle schools, high schools, colleges, and universities to have mandatory civics. And I would simply say, you know, we wouldn't let someone graduate school not being able to read or write, not being able to count. Well, why is being a citizen in a democracy any less central to that individual and to our collective welfare than these other skills? So I actually think that there needs to be a movement to make civics mandatory. It then, I understand, I'm not naive here. We then have the challenge of coming up with civics that are good and that are widely acceptable. Mm-hmm. All I can say is I'm going to devote a significant chunk of my life going forward to trying to develop that kind of a curriculum at the state and ultimately national level. I just think in part our ability as Americans to stay united requires that we have some common understanding of this country's past, and its present, its values. And if that's the only way, I think we have a chance of working together across our differences.
Thanks for the call, Steve. We're talking to Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His newest book is called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the sort of civic obligations he's hoping to promote? Do you want to throw in one of your own? Something you'd like to see, something you see as maybe even a bare minimum of participating in society and politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at his new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. I'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Alice is with us calling from Madison. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Alice?
I just think that there's two things that we should be doing when asked, and one is vote. And the other one is serve on juries, because those are the obligations that make our system work. There's other things we can do, but those are obligations.
Alice, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, you have different lines on what might be required and what people should do of their own volition. Alice is we have to vote and we have to be willing to serve on a jury. What do you think?
Well, we don't have to vote in this country. I'd like to think that Americans will vote. You know, there are countries where you're required to vote or show up at the polling place, Australia being one, and if you don't, you're fined. I don't think that would be well received here. But I would like Americans to want to vote, and I would like there to be a situation where those who want to vote don't find it all that difficult, where employers make it easy for employees to vote, where there are adequate polling stations open for a sufficient amount of time, where voting doesn't involve more hurdles, shall we say, than it needs to. But the bigger problem, it turns out, is voters who simply don't take advantage of their right to vote. You know, it's ironic that we've spent so much of our history promoting the right to vote in other countries, and we have a lot of Americans who, for one reason or another, aren't taking advantage of it here. But I think it's central. And as I said before, I want people to get involved in politics. I want them to vote. And I'd love that to be against a backdrop where they are first informed. Jury obligations are a little bit more than that. It's more of a requirement. I would simply say having done it, it's a really interesting thing to do. And it gets you often with people who you might not normally come into contact with at work or in your neighborhoods. And you see the legal system in action. I don't think you'll ever watch the news quite the same way again if you've served on a jury and you've seen what it's like. So I know so many people spend a lot of calories trying to get out of jury service. It's never convenient. It's never a good time. But it turns out that doing it can be quite revealing. And again, it's something that we owe the system. And if you know we ever find ourselves in hot water ourselves, we're going to want good people to serve on juries. So again, it's a little bit of doing things that you wish that you'd like to think others would do for you.
Alice, thanks for the call. Laura joins us now, also in Madison. Laura, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually have thought a lot about having a mandatory national service year or 2 years as part of just a national norm, and I've had a lot of internal thought experiments, but how would that even work? Like Israel has mandatory service for their youth, but there's a small portion that choose like public service if they have a strong objection to military service. And I'm not suggesting everyone go into the military. I'm thinking service in Senior Corps, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, and kind of equalizing the term service to not just mean military service, but serving your country in all the different ways we need, because I'm a nurse, and gosh, we need help caring for our seniors as they get older. We need child care.
Laura, point taken. Richard, and you write about ideas of national service, possibly required national service in your book. What are your thoughts on that?
I think national service is really important. There's a lot of areas in this society, as Laura pointed out, where we need more people involved. I also think it'd be really good for this society. We now have a reality where we have so few common experiences. We're separated by geography, by race, by gender, by religion, by class, by politics. And what I love about national service is it would bring people together who might not normally ever come into contact with one another. It could also be a good way to pick up skills. Could be a good way also to teach some civics as part of the experience. I don't think, though, it should be mandatory. I think that would never get accepted, and that would become almost a distraction. So I think what we need to do is make service more desirable, to incentivize it one way or another, whether through economic means. Firms could give could make hiring people who had service, could give them points, if you will, for that. School colleges might say we're more likely to admit someone if he or she takes a year or two off after high school and get some experience in this way. And I think it would be good for the individuals, and I think it would be good for the society. And I also think, by the way, there's a chance that Congress could actually come together on this. I've spoken to both Republican and Democratic members of Congress. There's a lot of interest in this. And if they were to come together on this, there would then be some resources that would, again, be central if we were going to incentivize people of any age to do this for a year or two. So I actually think this may be an idea whose time has come or will come before long.
Thanks for the call, Laura. We're talking to Richard Haass about his new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Back to your calls. Jerry is with us in Pewaukee. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I, of course, enjoying the discussion. And, of course, participation and involvement is very important in a general way. But I did want to make the point that I know that many Americans are increasingly upset with the levels of toxicity in our politics. Whether you support the left and the right, there's tremendous disinformation and dishonesty on both sides. There's spin, there's federal investigations of members of Congress and the White House. And so I'd like to hear the gentleman's response regarding there seems to be a valid amount of data for why people would not want to participate in the system.
Interesting point, Jerry. Richard, what do you think?
Look, I understand full well why people are disaffected with the system. They see policies that are not yielding results that have improved their life, whether it's now inflation or there's problems with crime, problems at the border. People disagreed with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a long list. I understand the disaffection. And I also understand why people are put off. Some of the behavior last night at the State of the Union, talk about a lack of civility, a lack of respect for norms. The problem with not getting involved, though, is that you leave politics and the country's future in the hands of others. And why should anyone think that they are going to look out for the collective interest, much less your interest? So my view is if you're disaffected, if you're frustrated, then double down on your efforts. Get involved. It's the only way I know to change it if more people vote. Apathy and standing aloof is a recipe, I think, for people who often have more extreme views to have a to have a disproportionate sway over the future of this country.
Jerry, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, Richard, your final step here is a plea, really, for people at all levels, including politicians, to put country first. Could you leave us with a minute of thoughts on that?
Sure. It's me doing my best effort to channel JFK in his inaugural address, the ask not what your country can do for you, what you can do for your country. The good news is we see examples of it. Whatever you think of their policy positions, Liz Cheney, I think, was an example of it. Some of the state secretaries of state at the state level who stood by the integrity of the political process, even there were pressures not to. So there are Americans willing to do the right thing. And then it's up to us to reward them, not to penalize them for putting the country first. It's up to us to make sure that people who do put the country first are rewarded for doing so.
And just briefly, the book just came out last week. What kind of response are you getting so far?
Well, good news, I'm proud to say, is it made the New York Times bestseller list at number 10. And I think what that says is not so much that the book is great. People will form their own opinions when they read it. But I'm tapping into something. People know there's something a bit off the rails, a bit amiss with American politics, with what's going on in our society, in our democracy. And a lot of people out there, even people who may disagree politically, know that we have to do something different to save this experiment called the United States of America.
Richard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. We talked with him about his new book. It's called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a political rhetoric expert about President Biden's State of the Union address last night and how he handled the messaging to his own party and to his critics. Then we'll hear from another candidate in Wisconsin's race for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. Remember, you can follow election information and news online anytime at WPR.org or on the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll talk to Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell about the race and some of the big issues facing the justices. Now, President Biden held his second State of the Union address last night, where he highlighted his work on top issues surrounding the economy, health care, and infrastructure. He pushed for more bipartisan cooperation, but also leveled criticism at some Republicans, leading to outbursts and jeers from lawmakers in the crowd.
Some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy of the proposal. That means Congress doesn't vote. Well, I'm glad to see you. And I tell you, I enjoy conversion.
Some Republican members of Congress interrupted him a few times throughout the speech and provided a snapshot of the current political landscape in Washington. Allison Prash is an assistant professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. Her research and teaching focuses on U.S. presidential rhetoric, public address, and foreign policy. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, maybe it's obvious from that clip, but what stood out to you the most from the State of the Union address?
Well, you know, as you noted, there was obviously this attempt by the president to talk about bipartisanship, but also clear heckling from Republican lawmakers. You know, what I think is interesting is that Biden really utilized this moment to both speak to his desire for bipartisanship, but to also meet the Republicans where they were. I mean, I think in the last 10, 15 years, we've really seen a decrease in some of the political decorum that you would have expect in a State of the Union address. There's the pomp and the circumstance that we often associate with it. But in the last 10 years, you've seen that really decrease. You can think about, for example, in 2009, when Representative Joe Wilson interrupts Barack Obama and says, you lie. You can think about Nancy Pelosi making the decision to rip up Trump's State of the Union speech in 2020. And so I think Biden knew that he was going into a fraught political environment, and he also took the opportunity to use it to his advantage.
Now, the State of the Union, I know we in the media get really excited about it. How much does it matter as a chance for the president to address the members of Congress in person, of course, but the viewers at home as well?
Well, obviously, he's speaking, attempting to speak to a vast swath of the electorate. I think we often see these memorable news clips that come out of the speech, such as the one that you played in the introduction. But you know what? I think what Biden is doing today and tomorrow, we see this through his visit to the Madison area in particular, is taking key aspects of his message and then sharing them with a broader public. So it's one thing to see the president speaking from the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. It's another thing to see him touting his accomplishments or his message to ordinary people. And that's what he's doing today in Madison, and he'll do later this week in Florida.
Now, these speeches often end up being kind of a laundry list of, here's what we've done, here's what we're trying to do. How much of that did you see in this speech versus the bipartisan outreach, the opposite of bipartisan needling of the other party?
It was, in some sense, a laundry list of accomplishments. A lot of political commentators have been talking about the fact that this was really an attempt for Biden and his advisors to do a test run of some of his key core messaging for 2024. I mean, I think you did see some of that last night. I will also say, though, that there was a bit more fiery language or interest, political spectacle, we could say, in this exchange between Biden and members of the House. But you also saw Biden's clear rhetorical style, his ability in the moment when individuals might have been heckling him to try and get him off script. He was able to engage with them in a way that is quite remarkable, particularly for someone who's been open about the fact that he deals with a speech impediment. And so he was able to really engage with hecklers, with Republicans, and still amplify his political messaging in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time.
Well, it's interesting because I think through his career, President Biden has not been known as someone who delivers a script really well. If anything, people see his ability to react in the moment as something he's actually stronger at. So it seemed like Republican leadership was trying not to give him those opportunities.
I think you're absolutely correct. And aides will often say that Biden is really energized by these individual exchanges from people. Oftentimes, they're talking about ordinary voters, walking the rope lines. This was a really unique moment in which, who knows about the intentions of these hecklers, but it could have been seen as an attempt to really throw him off script, really phase him in a particular way. But Biden looked like he was relishing the opportunity. And in fact, there's this memorable moment where Biden is saying to his audience, OK, stand up for seniors. If you're really saying that you're not going to cut Medicare, cut Social Security, stand up. And at the State of the Union, we pay a lot of attention to who is standing or applauding about particular proposals. And Biden really forced his audience to take a stand quite literally on where they stood on this issue in a way that I think is going to come back perhaps to haunt some Republicans going forward.
Talking to Allison Prash from UW-Madison, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric, Politics, and Culture, looking at last night's State of the Union address. You could join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When it came to the framing of key issues, we talked a little bit about Medicare and Social Security, police reform, things like that. What do you make of the way that President Biden presented those issues, I think, trying to reach out not just to supporters, but to, I guess, a hypothetical middle America?
he absolutely did. I mean, I think that's one of the things that would characterize what Biden has attempted to do over the last 2 years. There was, this phrase that he kept utilizing in the speech, finish the job, finish the job. He utilized this over a dozen times. And really the message that he was trying to send to perhaps undecided voters or the middle of the road voter is, you're tired of bickering, you're tired of partisan infighting. Here are the clear policies and proposals that I'm putting forward that's going to impact real everyday working Americans, is how he framed it. And so, whether that reached those particular voters remains to be seen, but I think he was attempting to do so.
Now, it's kind of always election season in the United States. That said, the State of the Union happens about as far away from the next federal election, especially in an odd-numbered year. Is this an opportunity for a Democratic president and a Republican House majority to work together a little bit, to compromise a little bit, and know that some of that's going to fade away before they have to run for election again?
The optimist in me says yes. The pessimist in me says that it remains to be seen how Speaker McCarthy and a new Republican controlled House of Representatives wants to foil Biden's plans. They know that he is most likely, if not certainly, going to announce his decision to run again in 2024. We also know that Donald Trump has already announced his bid for 2024. And so if Republican members of Congress wanted to get something done, they might attempt to compromise, but they may also see their job as an attempt to be a needle in Biden's side going into the general election.
Now, we've got Sarah Sanders delivering the Republican response. She's a governor, of course, but she's best known nationally, I think, for her time speaking for the Trump administration. What do you think of that? What do you make of that selection of her to give that response, which is always a tough gig, no matter which party's doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what both Speaker McCarthy and also Mitch McConnell said about their selection of her to give that response, it was really stressing a new generation of Republican leadership. There's this memorable line that she says in the speech that I'm the nation's youngest governor at 40, Biden's the oldest president at 80. So she's really trying to put a stark contrast both on Biden's age, which many people see as a liability, both Republicans and Democrats, but she's really trying to subtly suggest that it's time for a new wave of Republican leadership. Now, she doesn't name Trump directly, but there is that inference, and I think that is part of a larger conversation about, is DeSantis, Republican governor of Florida, going to enter the race? Other possible challengers to Trump, and that remains to be seen.
Yeah, some changing of the guard here. Again, two of the oldest presidents in American history have been the last two presidents. But then we see Speaker Nancy Pelosi now not taking on the mantle of minority leader. Are you seeing signs of more generational shifts in who's leading this country?
I mean, I think the general voter would like to see those shifts. I think one of the problems or conundrums that we see is that there can be this kind of dominance of age that continues. It's also the case that it's difficult to look at who would be the next nominee for the Democratic Party, for example, just as it is a conversation about, you know, who would be that next nominee for the Republican Party. We know historically that younger presidential candidates have done quite well. You look at Barack Obama, for example, or John F. Kennedy. Those were, you know, very successful first bids for president. But it remains to be seen how that's going to play out for 2024.
I wanted to ask you more specifically about the decorum issue. You know, we have the heckling during the thing. It was a little more like the British Parliament a little bit. Does it matter, though? I mean, are we really decorum-y people in the United States? Do we care if it's a little bit of rough and tumble in this big annual address?
You know, I think that there is the image or the ideal that exists in the mind of the American electorate of what a State of the Union address looks like, sounds like. The moment where, you know, the person introducing the president says, you know, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. I think for some people, however, there could be an appeal to the back and forth exchanges between Biden and Republicans in this instance. In fact, in some ways, it does remind me of Trump's rhetorical style and how, as president, he would often interrupt or provide these asides. It's a much more informal style of speaking and communicating. I think there is something different, though, about the pomp and circumstance of the State of the Union. But then again, Biden demonstrated his ability to handle it quite well and, in fact, use it to his political advantage. So it remains to be seen if this will be, you know, a change in how we think about State of the Union addresses or if this is just a one-off. And I don't know. It remains to be seen.
You mentioned the president's visit today to Wisconsin. We get a lot of love here in Wisconsin. We're a very closely divided state when it comes to statewide elections. Do you expect to see lots and lots of presidential contenders make their way through Wisconsin in the next couple of years?
I do. I mean, we saw both in 2016 and 2020 how pivotal the state of Wisconsin was. I think it's also important to remember that Republicans are poised to host the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee in 2024. And so that is always a big boost to the image of that particular party in the state. So I think Biden making the decision to come to both Wisconsin and Madison as his first stop after the State of the Union is incredibly important. I think that we'll see a majority of contenders coming through the state. And I think it's going to play a really important role in the 2024 presidential election overall.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison Prash, an assistant professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. She was with us today to look at President Biden and how he handled his second State of the Union address and some outbursts from lawmakers in the crowd. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. That's up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. The outcome of the April general election could shift the ideological balance of the court, which is widely seen as having a 4-3 conservative majority in the current lineup. Before the primary election on February 21st, Central Time invited all the candidates to join us to talk about the race. Yesterday, we heard from Daniel Kelly and Janet Protasewicz. Everett Mitchell is a Dane County Circuit Court judge where he presides over juvenile court. He's also an adjunct professor at the UW-Madison Law School and serves as senior pastor of Christ the Solid Rock Baptist Church in Madison. Judge Mitchell, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate your time with us.
Can you start with your basic elevator pitch? Why do you think people should elect you to the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, I believe that our state deserves a justice that reflects the diversity and ideas of our entire state. I've been around the state at least twice with this idea that justice is not simply what you say, it's also what you do. That there are two races going on in our state. One that we rightly focus on reproductive choice, fair maps, decisions, and voting access, where there's also another communication and conversation that is focused on criminal justice reform and justice as relates to access to the courts, how communities of color are being addressed and how they have access to the things that they need in order to make sure that their communities are stronger and made better. And so I'm the best candidate to be able to bring those community conversations together so that we can have a justice that brings those experiences to the courts to follow both the rule of law, but also have the capacity to provide the leadership to address mental health and violence and public safety and just overall integrity of the court, return it back to a place of integrity and strength.
Now, people look at the state Supreme Court and fairly or not say these are conservative justices, these are liberals. The same with the candidates. You are often labeled as one of the liberal candidates in this race. What do you say to people who put that label on you?
I will say that, you know, that creates the tension in these races. I think, really liberal and conservative are nothing but synonyms for Democrats and Republicans, which often creates the inability for us to be able to have conversations with both sides. I think regardless as a judge, there's reason why they're nonpartisan so that you could be able to talk to various groups about the various decisions that they're looking to see in their justices. And I think the labels often create the tension where we aren't able to have an independent, thoughtful, reflective conversation about the values of Wisconsinites and what they would like to see in their justice. So there are those where I talk about my values, and as long as I'm talking about my values, we can talk about how my life and my work has aligned with the need to, you know, keep our community safe, to make sure that people receive the trauma-informed care and that we're not using the criminal justice system as a mental health dumping ground, but rather being proactive to solve the problems so that we are not just locking up futures of people, but that we're protecting futures of individuals. And where that lines up, you know, I'll let the voters be able to decide that.
Now, people might hear that and say, even if they agree with your goals there, they're in a way policy goals, and that's not really the job of a state Supreme Court justice. That's to interpret the law. What would you say to that?
I would say that that's why we need to educate individuals about what the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court doesn't just simply follow just the rules and make decisions on case. They have significant leadership and legislative responsibilities that they still will address policies. They still address, you know, judicial education. They deal with lawyer regulation. They set budgeting policies for the Supreme Courts. They also can create and bring together committees to solve, you know, current concerns that are happening all throughout our court. I mean, just here recently, the Chief Justice called together a committee to address mental health. Right. And starting to pull together, you know, prosecutors, public defenders offers, you know, community groups from all throughout the state to start saying what should courts be doing about, you know, mental health and the mental health crises that judges are seeing in their communities. So I think the ways in which we have miseducated our community makes them think that this is limited to just cases, when in reality, there's a whole nother administrative side to the Supreme Court that they're engaging in changing. I mean, quite honestly, when we could not get legislative changes to take handcuffs off of young people in court, we went to the Supreme Court and won a petition before the Supreme Court so that we could put in statute that children are presumed to come into courts without any kind of handcuffs, belts, or restraints. We didn't do that during legislation, but it ended up in the legislation because we were able to go through the Supreme Court to do so.
Talking to Judge Everett Mitchell, a candidate for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Judge Mitchell, one of the biggest decisions people are watching for here relates to Roe versus Wade. After the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down, we have this 1849 law in effect in the state. There is a legal challenge to that law saying, hey, there's a law in the 1980s that supersedes it, is the argument there. In a case like that, with two different laws from two different eras, how would you evaluate that case before the Supreme Court?
I'm really not sure how we evaluate it. It's going to be very interesting because the incorrect way in which the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe has really left without any kind of guidance on what is the way for us to evaluate. And so you will see very different degrees across very different states engaging in these conversations about what is the proper standard to evaluate. Is it privacy? Is it due process? Is it equal protection? And I think when we go back and start to assess here in our own state, I think those at least the three lenses that, you know, majority of states, even in South Carolina, when their Supreme Court chose to rule unconstitutional some of their legislative restrictions related to reproductive access, you know, they did it on the ground of privacy and equal protection. So I think there are still going to be some lens in which we need to apply. And I think at least the due process, equal protection, privacy laws that, you know, we have generally, you know, structured other rights around are going to be those that that maybe lawyers and judges will agree are the standards. But at this point, there really isn't any standard because there's no case that has been evaluated in the era post the overturning of Roe.
Once in a great while, parties before the state Supreme Court will ask for or hope that one of the justices recuse themselves from a particular case because of personal connections or campaign contributions. What do you think should be the standard for when a state Supreme Court justice should recuse themselves from a case?
I think the notion that, you know, you are to recuse yourself because of campaign donations it breaks apart the spirit in which we should be having these races in the first place. I've always often advocated for a merit-based system in these races because it costs so much money to be able to, you know, be able to get on TV, to get your message out, to be able to respond in such a manner that, you know, people are going to always be put into a compromised position because you're having to take money from so many different sources, from so many different organizations that are aligned in a certain political direction. And because of that, I don't think anybody will be able to be in a space where if we adopted a recusal that was based on donations, you would literally have a no court whatsoever, anybody ever been able to hear any case whatsoever, because everybody has accepted donations from so many different sources that if one has to recuse, then every last one of them would have to recuse at the same time.
And finally, we would assume that state Supreme Court justices would be collegial, even that when they disagree. That has broken down at some points in recent Wisconsin history. How would you approach collegial relations, even when there's maybe intense debate about a ruling?
You know, it was funny that you asked that question, because last night we were at an event, a lawyers judges event in Milwaukee, where I was talking with Justice Rebecca Bradley and, even my opponent, Dan Kelly. And we had a conversation about the necessity for civility in our courts. And, you know, Justice Bradley and I talked about the idea that, you know, you have to be careful how you talk about people and after you talk about, you know, individuals. You know, as judges, we should be willing to go after decisions, right? We should focus our opinions on decisions and words that are written decisions. But some of these veiled disrespectful attacks and how we attack individuals' words only weaken our capacity to get into a space and argue about legal ideas and then walk away. I mean, come on, let's be honest with it. We saw Anton Scalia and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may they both rest in peace. I mean, that was an odd couple, but they found a way to pay attention to the law, right, and not attack each other. And I think until we get back to a place we recognize attacking one another is not the model, but attacking ideas and then step back and say, you know, how does this impact our state? I think that's the model that I'm running on. That's the model that I'm building. And you will not see me do that to any of my opponents, because that's not the mature, reflective, compassionate, kind, or judicial way for us to behave. And Wisconsin needs a value system that allows for us to return that dignity back to our courts.
Thanks to our guest, Judge Everett Mitchell, Dane County Circuit Court judge, a candidate running for the state Supreme Court. We heard from two candidates, Daniel Kelly and Janet Pertazewicz. Yesterday, the fourth candidate, Jennifer Doro, a judge, has not responded to our requests. I just saw an article on CNN investigating the question, how often do you really need to wash your clothes? Long story short, it says the more the clothes touch your skin, the more regularly they need to be washed. Okay, but I bring it up because it reminded me of something I saw a while back. I wear blue jeans like pretty much all the time. I could do that because it's radio. And I kept seeing stuff where a jeans company and other people said, hey, you don't need to wash them as much as you think you do. So I looked at the company's website. It said and still says it might vary depending on use, but in general, wash your blue jeans once every 10 wears. Except at first I misread it as once every 10 years. I figured it out a few moments later, but I briefly lived in that mental reality and I thought my jeans don't even last 10 years. But then I thought maybe it's because I wash them. So I'm not doing a once a decade washing plan. I'll be honest, I don't even go for 10 wears between washing. Clothing care news you can use. This is Central Time.